Now, Chilean students didn't need to travel all the way to the U.S. Hundreds could get a Chicago school education without leaving home. The students who went through the program, whether in Chicago or its franchise operation in Santiago, became known throughout the region as Los Chicago Boys. With more funding from USAID, Chile's Chicago Boys became enthusiastic regional ambassadors for neoliberalism, traveling to Argentina and Colombia to set up more University of Chicago franchises in order to expand this knowledge throughout Latin America, confronting the ideological positions which prevented freedom and perpetuated poverty and backwardness, according to one Chilean graduate. Juan Gabriel Valdez, Chile's foreign minister in the 1990s, described the process of training hundreds of Chilean economists in Chicago school orthodoxy as a striking example of an organized transfer of ideology from the United States to a country within its direct sphere of influence. The education of these Chileans derived from a specific project designed in the 1950s to influence the development of Chilean economic thinking. As a form of intellectual imperialism, it was certainly unabashed. There was, however, a problem. It wasn't working. According to a 1957 report from the University of Chicago to its funders at the State Department, the central purpose of the project was to train a generation of students who would become the intellectual leaders in economic affairs in Chile. The Chicago Boys weren't leading their countries anywhere. In fact, they were being left behind. In the early 60s, the main economic debate in the Southern Cone was not about laissez-faire capitalism versus developmentalism, but about how best to take developmentalism to the next stage. At the polls and on the streets, the Southern Cone was surging to the left. It was in Chile, the epicenter of the Chicago experiment, that defeat in the battle of ideas was most evident. By Chile's historic 1970 elections, the country had moved so far left that all three major political parties were in favor of nationalizing the country's largest source of revenue, the copper mines, then controlled by U.S. mining giants. The Chile Project, in other words, was an expensive bust. As ideological warriors waging a peaceful battle of ideas with their left-wing foes, the Chicago Boys had failed in their mission. Not only was the economic debate continuing to shift leftward, but the Chicago Boys were so marginal that they did not even register on the Chilean electoral spectrum. It might have ended there, with the Chile Project just a minor historical footnote. But something happened to rescue the Chicago Boys from obscurity. Richard Nixon was elected President of the United States. Nixon had an imaginative and, on the whole, effective foreign policy, Friedman enthused, and nowhere was it more imaginative than in Chile. It was Nixon who would give the Chicago Boys and their professors something they had long dreamed of, a chance to prove that their capitalist utopia was more than a theory in a basement workshop, a shot at remaking a country from scratch. Democracy had been inhospitable to the Chicago Boys in Chile. Dictatorship would prove an easier fit. Salvador Allende's popular unity government won Chile's 1970 elections on a platform promising to put into government hands large sectors of the economy that were being run by foreign and local corporations. Allende was a new breed of Latin American revolutionary. Like Che Guevara, he was a doctor. But unlike Che, he looked the part of the Tweedy academic, not the romantic guerrilla. He could deliver a stump speech as fiery as any by Fidel Castro, but he was a fierce Democrat who believed that socialist change in Chile needed to come through the ballot box, not the barrel of a gun. When Nixon heard that Allende had been elected president, he famously ordered the CIA director Richard Helms to make the economy scream. Although Allende pledged to negotiate fair terms to compensate companies that were losing property and investments, U.S. multinationals feared that Allende represented the beginning of a Latin America-wide trend, and many were unwilling to accept the prospect of losing what was a growing portion of their bottom line. By 1968, 20% of total U.S. foreign investment was tied up in Latin America, and U.S. firms had 5,436 subsidiaries in the region. The profits that these investments were able to produce were staggering. Mining companies had invested $1 billion over the previous 50 years in Chile's copper mining industry, the largest in the world. But they had sent $7.2 billion home. As soon as Allende won the vote, and before he was even inaugurated, corporate America declared war on his administration. The center of activity was the Washington-based Ad Hoc Committee on Chile, a group that included the major U.S. mining companies with holdings in Chile, as well as the de facto leader of the group, the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, ITT, which owns 70% of Chile's soon-to-be nationalized phone company. Purina, Bank of America, and Pfizer Chemical also sent delegates at various stages. The committee's single purpose was to force Allende to back off his nationalizations by confronting him with economic collapse. They had many ideas for how to make Allende feel the pain. According to declassified meeting minutes, they planned to block U.S. loans to Chile and quietly have large U.S. private banks do the same, confer with foreign banking sources with the same thing in mind, delay buying from Chile over the next 6 months, use U.S. copper stockpile instead of buying from Chile, bring about a scarcity of U.S. dollars in Chile, and the list goes on. Allende appointed his close friend Orlando Letelier to be his ambassador to Washington. That gave him the task of negotiating the terms of expropriation with the same corporations plotting to sabotage the Allende government. Letelier, a fun-loving extrovert with a quintessential 70s mustache and a devastating singing voice, was much beloved in diplomatic circles. But even with all Letelier's charm and skill, the negotiations never stood a chance of success. In March 1972, in the midst of Letelier's tense negotiation with ITT, Jack Anderson, a syndicated newspaper columnist, published an explosive series of articles based on documents that showed that the telephone company had secretly plotted with the CIA and the State Department to block Allende from being inaugurated 2 years earlier. In the face of these allegations, and with Allende still in power, the U.S. Senate, controlled by Democrats, launched an investigation and uncovered a far-reaching conspiracy in which ITT had offered $1 million in bribes to Chilean opposition forces and sought to engage the CIA in a plan covertly to manipulate the outcome of the Chilean presidential election. The Senate report, released in June 1973, ITT moved to a new strategy designed to ensure that he would not make it through the next 6 months. Most alarming to the Senate was the relationship between ITT executives and the U.S. government. In testimony and documents, it became clear that ITT was directly involved in shaping U.S. policy toward Chile at the highest level. The company also took the liberty of preparing an 18-point strategy for the Nixon administration that contained a clear call for a military coup. Get to reliable sources within the Chilean military, it stated. Build up their planned discontent against Allende, thus bring about necessity of his removal. Yet despite years of relentless American dirty tricks, of which ITT was only the most scrutinized example, in 1973 Allende was still in power. $8 million in covert spending had failed to weaken his base. In midterm parliamentary elections that year, Allende's party actually gained support beyond the number that had first elected it in 1970. Clearly, the desire for a different economic model had taken deep root in Chile, and support for a socialist alternative was growing. For Allende's opponents, who had been plotting his overthrow since the day the 1970 election results came in, that meant their problems would not be solved by simply getting rid of him. Someone else would just come along and replace him. A more radical plan was needed. Shortly after Allende was elected, the Catholic University, home of the Chicago Boys, became ground zero for the creation of what the CIA called a coup climate. Many students joined the fascist Patria y Libertad, and goose-stepped through the streets in open imitation of Hitler Youth. In September 1971, a year into Allende's mandate, the top business leaders in Chile held an emergency meeting in the seaside city of Viña del Mar to develop a coherent regime change strategy. According to Orlando Sanz, president of the National Association of Manufacturers, generously funded by the CIA and many of the same foreign multinationals doing their own plotting in Washington, the gathering decided that Allende's government was incompatible with freedom in Chile and with the existence of private enterprise, and that the only way to avoid the end was to overthrow the government. The businessmen formed a war structure, one part of which would liaise with the military, another, according to Sanz, would prepare specific alternative programs to government programs that would systematically be passed on to the armed forces. Sanz recruited several key Chicago boys to design those alternative programs and set them up in a new office near the presidential palace in Santiago. The group began holding weekly secret meetings during which they developed detailed proposals for how to radically remake their country along neoliberal lines. According to the subsequent U.S. Senate investigation, over 75% of the funding for this opposition research organization was coming directly from the CIA. For a time, the coup planning proceeded on two distinct tracks. The military plotted the extermination of Allende and his supporters, while the economists plotted the extermination of their ideas. As momentum built for a violent solution, a dialogue was opened between the two camps, with Roberto Kelly, a businessman associated with the CIA-financed newspaper El Mercurio, acting as the go-between. Through Kelly, the Chicago boys sent a 5-page summary of their economic program to the Navy admiral in charge. The Navy gave the nod, and from then on, the Chicago boys worked frantically to have their program ready by the time of the coup. This 500-page document, an economic program that would guide the junta from its earliest days, came to be known in Chile as the BRIC. According to a later U.S. Senate committee, CIA collaborators were involved in preparing an initial overall economic plan which has served as the basis for the junta's most important economic decisions. 8 of the 10 principal authors of the BRIC had studied economics at the University of Chicago. Although the overthrow of Allende was universally described as a military coup, Orlando Letelier, Allende's Washington ambassador, saw it as an equal partnership between the army and the economists. The Chicago boys, as they are known in Chile, Letelier wrote, convinced the generals that they were prepared to supplement the brutality which the military possessed with the intellectual assets it lacked. Chile's coup, when it finally came, would feature 3 distinct forms of shock, a recipe that would be duplicated in neighboring countries and would reemerge 3 decades later in Iraq. The shock of the coup itself was immediately followed by 2 additional forms of shock. One was Milton Friedman's capitalist shock treatment, a technique in which hundreds of Latin American economists had by now been trained at the University of Chicago and its various franchise institutions. The other was Ewan Cameron's shock, drug and sensory deprivation research, now codified as torture techniques in the Kubark Manual and disseminated through extensive CIA training programs for Latin American police and military. These 3 forms of shock converged on the bodies of Latin Americans and the body politic of the region, creating an unstoppable hurricane of mutually reinforcing destruction and reconstruction, erasure and creation. Out of this live laboratory emerged the first neoliberal state and the first victory in its global counter-revolution. States of Shock, the Bloody Birth of the Counter-Revolution. General Augusto Pinochet and his supporters consistently referred to the events of September 11, 1973, not as a coup d'etat, but as a war. Santiago certainly looked like a war zone. Tanks fired as they rolled down the boulevards, and government buildings were under air assault by fighter jets. But there was something strange about this war. It had only one side. From the start, Pinochet had complete control of the army, navy, marines, and police. Meanwhile, President Salvador Allende had refused to organize his supporters into armed defense leagues, so he had no army of his own. The only resistance came from the presidential palace, La Moneda, and the rooftops around it, where Allende and his inner circle made a valiant effort to defend the seat of democracy. It was hardly a fair fight. Though there were just 36 Allende supporters inside, the military launched 24 rockets into the palace. Pinochet, the operation's vain and volatile commander, built like one of the tanks he rode in on, clearly wanted the event to be as dramatic and traumatic as possible. Even if the coup was not a war, it was designed to feel like one. A Chilean precursor to shock and awe. It could scarcely have been more shocking. Unlike neighboring Argentina, which had been ruled by 6 military governments in the previous 4 decades, Chile had no experience with this kind of violence. It had enjoyed 160 years of peaceful democratic rule, the past 41 uninterrupted.
The president's shrouded body was being carried out on a stretcher,
and his closest colleagues were lying face down in the street at rifle point. A few minutes' drive from the presidential palace, Orlando Letelier, recently returned from Washington to take up a new post as Chile's defense minister, had gone to his office that morning in the ministry. As soon as he walked through the front door, he was ambushed by 12 soldiers in combat uniform, all pointing their submachine guns at him. With Allende dead, his cabinet in captivity, and no mass resistance in evidence, the junta's grand battle was over by mid-afternoon. Letelier and the other VIP prisoners were eventually taken to freezing Dawson Island in the southern Strait of Magellan, Pinochet's approximation of a Siberian work camp. Killing and locking up the government was not enough for Chile's new junta government, however. The generals were sure that their hold on power depended on Chileans being truly terrified. In the days that followed, roughly 13,500 civilians were arrested, loaded onto trucks, and imprisoned, according to a declassified CIA report. Thousands ended up in the 2 main football stadiums in Santiago, the Chile Stadium and the huge National Stadium. Inside the National Stadium, death replaced football as the public spectacle. Soldiers prowled the bleachers with hooded collaborators who pointed out subversives. The ones who were selected were hauled off to locker rooms and skyboxes transformed into makeshift torture chambers. Hundreds were executed. Lifeless bodies started showing up on the side of major highways or floating in murky urban canals. To make sure that the terror extended beyond the capital city, roving death squads singled out the highest profile prisoners, as many as 26 at a time, and executed them. The entire country had gotten the message. Resistance is deadly. The Economic Front. On the day of the coup, several Chicago boys were camped out at the printing presses of the right-wing El Mercurio newspaper. As shots were being fired in the streets outside, they frantically tried to get the document printed in time for the junta's first day on the job. Before midday the next day, the general officers of the armed forces who perform government duties had the plan on their desks. The proposals in the final document bore a striking resemblance to those found in Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. Privatization, deregulation, and cuts to social spending. The free market trinity. "To us it was a revolution," said Christian Larolet, one of Pinochet's economic aides. It was a fair description. September 11, 1973, was far more than the violent end of Allende's peaceful socialist revolution. It was the beginning of what The Economist would later describe as a counter-revolution. The first concrete victory in the Chicago school campaign to seize back the gains that had been won under developmentalism and Keynesianism. In the coming years, the same policies laid out in The Brick would be imposed in dozens of other countries under cover of a wide range of crises. Jose Piñera, an alumnus of the economics department at the Catholic University and a self-described Chicago boy, was doing graduate work at Harvard at the time of the coup. On hearing the good news, he returned home to help found a new country dedicated to liberty from the ashes of the old one. According to Piñera, who would eventually become Pinochet's Minister of Labor and Mining, this was the real revolution, a radical, comprehensive, and sustained move toward free markets. Augusto Pinochet took to power with unseemly relish, adopting the airs of a monarch and claiming that destiny had given him the job. In short order, he staged a coup within a coup to unseat the other 3 military leaders with whom he had agreed to share power, and named himself Supreme Chief of the Nation, as well as President. He basked in pomp and ceremony, proof of his right to rule, never missing an opportunity to put on his Prussian dress uniform
complete with cape. To get around Santiago, he chose a caravan of gold, bulletproof Mercedes-Benzes. Pinochet had a knack for authoritarian rule, but he knew next to nothing about economics. That was a problem, because the campaign of corporate sabotage spearheaded by ITT had done an effective job of sending the economy into a tailspin, and Pinochet had a full-fledged crisis on his hands. From the start, there was a power struggle within the junta between those who simply wanted to reinstate the pre-Allende status quo and return quickly to democracy, and the Chicago boys, who were pushing for a head-to-toe free market makeover that would take years to impose. It was the Chicago boys' vision of a total country overhaul that appealed to Pinochet's newly unleashed ambition, and he immediately named several Chicago grads as senior economic advisors. He called them the technos, the technicians, which appealed to the Chicago pretension that fixing an economy was a matter of science, not of subjective human choices. For the first year and a half, Pinochet faithfully followed the Chicago rules. He privatized some, though not all, state-owned companies, including several banks. He allowed cutting-edge new forms of speculative finance. He flung open the borders to foreign imports, tearing down the barriers that had long protected Chilean manufacturers. And he cut government spending by 10%, except the military, which received a significant increase. He also eliminated price controls, a radical move in a country that had been regulating the cost of necessities such as bread and cooking oil for decades. The Chicago boys had confidently assured Pinochet that if he suddenly withdrew government involvement from these areas all at once, the natural laws of economics would rediscover their equilibrium, and inflation, which they viewed as a kind of economic fever indicating the presence of unhealthy organisms in the market, would magically go down. They were mistaken. In 1974, inflation reached 375%, the highest rate in the world and almost twice the top level under Allende. The cost of basics such as bread went through the roof. At the same time, Chileans were being thrown out of work because Pinochet's experiment with free trade was flooding the country with cheap imports. Local businesses were closing in droves, unable to compete. Unemployment hit record levels and hunger became rampant. The Chicago school's first laboratory was in freefall. Sergio de Castro and the other Chicago boys argued that the problem didn't lie with their theory, but with the fact that it wasn't being applied with sufficient strictness. The economy had failed to correct itself because there were still distortions left over from nearly half a century of government interference. Pinochet had to strip these distortions away. More cuts, more privatization, more speed. In that year and a half, many of the country's business elite had had their fill of the Chicago boys' adventures in extreme capitalism. The only people benefiting were foreign companies and a small clique of financiers known as the Piranhas, who were making a killing on speculation. The nuts and bolts manufacturers Orlando were strongly Sand, supported the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, who had brought the Chicago boys into the coup plot in the first place, declared the results of the experiment one of the greatest failures of our economic history. The manufacturers hadn't wanted Allende socialism, but had liked a managed economy just fine. Their agenda now in grave danger, the Chicago boys and the Piranhas decided it was time to call in the big guns. In March 1975, Milton Friedman and Arnold Harberger flew to Santiago at the invitation of a major bank to help save the experiment. Greeted by the junta-controlled press as something of a rock star, the guru of the new order, Friedman hammered at a single theme. The junta was off to a good start, but it needed to embrace the free market with greater abandon. In speeches and interviews, he used a term that had never before been publicly applied to a real-world economic crisis. He called for shock treatment. He said it was the only medicine. Absolutely. There is no other. There is no other long-term solution. When a Chilean reporter pointed out that even Richard Nixon, then president of the U.S., imposed controls to temper the free market, Friedman snapped, "I don't approve of them. I believe we should not apply them. I am against economic intervention by the government in my own country as well as in Chile." After a private meeting with Pinochet, Friedman made some personal notes about the encounter which he reproduced decades later in his memoirs. He observed that the general was sympathetically attracted to the idea of a shock treatment, but was clearly distressed at the possible temporary unemployment that might be caused. At this point, Pinochet was already notorious the world over for ordering massacres in football stadiums. That the dictator was distressed by the human cost of shock therapy might have given Friedman pause. But Friedman assured the general that if he followed his advice to cut government spending even further, Pinochet would be able to take credit for an economic miracle. He could end inflation in months, while the unemployment problem would be equally brief and that subsequent recovery would be rapid. Immediately after Friedman's visit, Pinochet fired his economic minister and handed the job to Sergio de Castro, whom he later promoted to finance minister. De Castro stacked the government with his fellow Chicago boys, appointing one of them to head the central bank. Orlando Sanz, who had objected to the mass layoffs and plant closures, was replaced as head of the Association of Manufacturers by someone with a more shock-friendly attitude. Freed of the naysayers, Pinochet and De Castro got to work stripping away the welfare state to arrive at their pure capitalist utopia. In 1975, they cut public spending by 27% in one blow, and they kept cutting until by 1980 it was half of what it had been under Allende. Health and education took the heaviest hits. Even The Economist, a free market cheerleader, called it an orgy of self-mutilation. De Castro privatized almost 500 state-owned companies and banks, practically giving many of them away, since the point was to get them as quickly as possible into their rightful place in the economic order. He took no pity on local companies and removed even more trade barriers. The result was the loss of 177,000 industrial jobs between 1973 and 1983. By the mid-80s, manufacturing as a percentage of the economy dropped to levels last seen during the Second World War. Shock treatment was an apt description for what Friedman had prescribed. Pinochet had deliberately sent his country into a deep recession based on the untested theory that the sudden contraction would jolt the economy into health. But causing a recession or a depression is a brutal idea, since it necessarily creates mass poverty, which is why no political leader had until this point been willing to test the theory. Who wants to be responsible for what Business Week described as a Dr. Strangelove world of deliberately induced depression? Pinochet did. In the first year of Friedman-prescribed shock therapy, Chile's economy contracted by 15%, and unemployment, only 3% under Allende, reached 20%, a rate unheard of in Chile at the time. The country was certainly convulsing under its treatments. And contrary to Friedman's sunny predictions, the crisis lasted for years, not months. By 1986, one in five industrial workers had lost their jobs. The junta, which had instantly taken to Friedman's illness metaphors, was unapologetic, explaining that this path was chosen because it is the only one that goes directly to the sickness. Friedman concurred. When asked by a reporter whether the social cost of his policies would be excessive, he responded, "Silly question." To another reporter, he said, "My only concern is that they push it long enough and hard enough." Interestingly, the most powerful criticism of shock therapy came from one of Friedman's own former students, André Gunder Frank. During his time at the University of Chicago in the 50s, Gunder Frank, originally from Germany, had heard so much about Chile that when he graduated with a PhD in economics, he decided to go see for himself the country his professors had portrayed as a mismanaged developmentalist dystopia. He liked what he saw and ended up teaching at the University of Chile, then serving as an economic advisor to the government of Salvador Allende, for whom he developed a great respect. As a Chicago boy in Chile who had defected from the school's free market orthodoxy, Gunder Frank had a unique perspective on the country's economic adventure. One year after Friedman prescribed maximum shock, he wrote a rage-fueled, open letter to Arnold Harberger and Milton Friedman, in which he used his Chicago school education to examine how the Chilean patient has responded to your treatment. He calculated what it meant for a Chilean family to try to survive on what Pinochet claimed was a living wage. Roughly 74% of its income went simply to buying bread, forcing the family to cut out such luxury items as milk and bus fare to get to work. By comparison, under Allende, bread, milk, and bus fare took up 17% of a public employee's salary. Many children weren't getting milk at school either, since one of the junta's first moves had been to eliminate the school milk program. As a result of this cut, compounding the desperation at home, more and more students were fainting in class, and many stopped going altogether. Günter Frank saw a direct connection between the brutal economic policies imposed by his former classmates and the violence Pinochet had unleashed on the country. Friedman's prescriptions were so wrenching, the disaffected Chicago boy wrote, that they could not be imposed or carried out without the twin elements that underlie them all, military force and political terror. The myth of the Chilean miracle. Even three decades later, Chile is still held up by free market enthusiasts as proof that Friedmanism works.
The New York Times praised when Pinochet him for died in
transforming a bankrupt economy into the most prosperous in Latin America, while a Washington Post editorial said he had introduced the free market policies that produced the Chilean economic miracle. But the country's period of steady growth that is held up as proof of its miraculous success did not begin until the mid-80s, a full decade after the Chicago Boys implemented shock therapy. In 1982, despite its strict adherence to Chicago doctrine, Chile's economy crashed. Its debt exploded. It faced hyperinflation once again, and unemployment hit 30%, 10 times higher than it was under Allende. The main cause was that the piranhas, the Enron-style financial houses that the Chicago Boys had freed from all regulation, had bought up the country's assets on borrowed money and run up an enormous debt of $14 billion. The situation was so unstable that Pinochet was forced to do exactly what Allende had done. He nationalized many of these companies. In the face of the debacle, almost all the Chicago Boys lost their influential government posts, including Sergio de Castro. The only thing that protected Chile from complete economic collapse in the early 80s was that Pinochet had never privatized Codelco, the state copper mine company nationalized by Allende. That one company generated 85% of Chile's export revenues, which meant that when the financial bubble burst, the state still had a steady source of funds. It's clear that Chile never was the laboratory of pure free markets that its cheerleaders claimed. Instead, it was a country where a small elite leapt from wealthy to super rich in extremely short order. A highly profitable formula bankrolled by debt and heavily subsidized, then bailed out, with public funds. When the hype and salesmanship behind the miracle are stripped away, Chile under Pinochet and the Chicago Boys was not a capitalist state featuring a liberated market, but a corporatist one. What Chile pioneered under Pinochet was an evolution of corporatism, a mutually supporting alliance between a police state and large corporations, joining forces to wage all-out war on the third power sector, the workers. That war, what many Chileans understandably see as a war of the rich against the poor and middle class, is the real story of Chile's economic miracle. By 1988, when the economy had stabilized and was growing rapidly, 45% of the population had fallen below the poverty line. The richest 10% of Chileans, however, had seen their incomes increase by 83%. Even in 2007, Chile remained one of the most unequal societies in the world. Out of 123 countries in which the United Nations tracks inequality, Chile ranked 116th, making it the 8th most unequal country on the list. If that track record qualifies Chile as a miracle for Chicago school economists, perhaps shock treatment was never really about jolting the economy into health. Perhaps it was meant to do exactly what it did: hoover wealth up to the top and shock much of the middle class out of existence. In Chile, if you were outside the wealth bubble, the miracle looked like the Great Depression. But inside its airtight cocoon, the profits flowed so free and fast that the easy wealth made possible by shock therapy-style reforms have been the crack cocaine of financial markets ever since. And that is why the financial world did not respond to the obvious contradictions of the Chile experiment by reassessing the basic assumptions of laissez-faire. Instead, it reacted with the junkies' logic. Where is the next fix? The revolution spreads. The people vanish. For a time, the next fix came from other countries in Latin America's southern cone, where the Chicago school counter-revolution quickly spread. Brazil was already under the control of a U.S.-supported junta, and several of Friedman's Brazilian students held key positions. Friedman traveled to Brazil in 1973, at the height of the regime's brutality, and declared the economic experiment a miracle. In Uruguay, the military had staged a coup in 1973, and the following year decided to go the Chicago route. The effects on Uruguay's previously egalitarian society were immediate. Real wages dropped by 28%, and hordes of scavengers appeared on the streets of Montevideo for the first time. Next to join the experiment was Argentina in 1976, when a junta seized power from Isabel Perón. That meant that Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, and Brazil, the countries that had been showcases of developmentalism, were now all run by U.S.-backed military governments and were living laboratories of Chicago school economics. By the mid-70s, disappearances had become the primary enforcement tool of the Chicago school juntas throughout the Southern Cone. Rather than openly killing or even arresting their prey, soldiers would snatch them, take them to clandestine camps, torture and often kill them, then deny any knowledge. Bodies were thrown into mass graves. According to Chile's Truth Commission, established in May 1990, the secret police would dispose of some victims by dropping them into the ocean from helicopters, after first cutting their stomach open with a knife to keep the bodies from floating. The Argentine junta excelled at striking just the right balance between public and private horror, carrying out enough of its terror in the open that everyone knew what was going on, but simultaneously keeping enough secret that it could always be denied. When someone was targeted to be eliminated, a fleet of military vehicles showed up at that person's home or workplace and cordoned off the block, often with a helicopter buzzing overhead. In broad daylight and in full view of the neighbors, police or soldiers battered down the door and dragged out the victim, who often shouted his or her name before disappearing into a waiting Ford Falcon in the hope that news of the event would reach the family. Some covert operations were even more brazen. Police were known to board crowded city buses and drag passengers off by their hair. In the city of Santa Fe, a couple was kidnapped right at the altar on their wedding day, in front of a church filled with people. The public character of terror did not stop with the initial capture. Once in custody, prisoners in Argentina were taken to one of more than 300 torture camps across the country. Many of them were located in densely populated residential areas. One of the most notorious in a former athletic club on a busy street in Buenos Aires. Another in a schoolhouse in central Bahía Blanca. And yet another in a wing of a working hospital. At these torture centers, military vehicles sped in and out at odd hours. Screams could be heard through the badly insulated walls, and strange body-shaped parcels were spotted being carried in and out, all silently registered by the nearby residents. The results of CIA training and the methods codified in the Kubark Manual are unmistakable in all the human rights reports from the Southern Cone in this isolation period. Drugging, forced nudity, electroshock, and everywhere the terrible legacy of the McGill experiments in deliberately induced regression. Cleaning the slate. Terror does its work. In 1976, Orlando Letelier was back in Washington, D.C., no longer as an ambassador, but as an activist with a progressive think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. Haunted by thoughts of the colleagues and friends still facing torture in junta camps, Letelier used his newly recovered freedom to expose Pinochet's crimes and to defend Allende's record against the CIA propaganda machine. The activism was having an effect. and Pinochet faced universal condemnation for his human rights record. What frustrated Letellier, a trained economist, was that even as the world gasped in horror at reports of summary executions and electroshock in the jails, most were silent in the face of the economic shock therapy, or in the case of the international banks showering the junta with loans, downright giddy about Pinochet's embrace of free market fundamentals. Letellier rejected a frequently articulated notion that the junta had two separate, easily compartmentalized projects. One, a bold experiment in economic transformation, the other, an evil system of grisly torture and terror. There was only one project, the former ambassador insisted, in which terror was the central tool of the free market transformation. Letellier went so far as to write in a searing essay for The Nation that Milton Friedman, as the intellectual architect and unofficial advisor for the team of economists now running the Chilean economy, shared responsibility for Pinochet's crimes. The establishment of a free private economy and the control of inflation a la Friedman, Letellier argued, could not be done peacefully. The economic plan has had to be enforced, and in the Chilean context that could be done only by the killing of thousands, the establishment of concentration camps all over the country, the jailing of more than 100,000 persons in 3 years, regression for the majorities and economic freedom for small privileged groups are, in Chile, two sides of the same coin. There was, he wrote, an inner harmony between the free market and unlimited terror. Letellier's controversial article was published at the end of August 1976. Less than a month later, on September 21st, the 44-year-old economist was driving to work in downtown Washington, D.C. As he passed through the heart of the embassy district, a remote-controlled bomb planted under the driver's seat exploded, sending the car flying and blowing off both his legs. With his severed foot abandoned on the pavement, Letellier was rushed to George Washington Hospital. He was dead on arrival. An FBI investigation revealed that the bomb had been the work of Michael Townley, a senior member of Pinochet's secret police, later convicted in a U.S. federal court for the crime. The assassins had been admitted to the country on false passports with the knowledge of the CIA. Cleansing cultures. In Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay, the junta staged massive ideological cleanup operations, burning books by Freud, Marx, and Neruda, closing hundreds of newspapers and magazines, occupying universities, banning strikes and political meetings. Some of the most vicious attacks were reserved for the pink economists, whom the Chicago boys could not defeat before the coups. At the University of Chile, hundreds of professors were fired for inobservance of moral duties, including André Gunder Frank, the dissident Chicagoan who wrote angry letters home to his former professors. During the coup, Gunder Frank reported that six students were shot on sight in the main entrance to the School of Economics to offer an object lesson to the remainder. In Santiago, the legendary left-wing folk singer Victor Jara was among those taken to the Chile Stadium. His treatment was the embodiment of the furious determination to silence a culture. First, the soldiers broke both his hands so he could not play the guitar. Then they shot him 44 times. To make sure he could not inspire from beyond the grave, the regime ordered his master recordings destroyed. A culture was being deliberately exterminated. Corporate-sponsored torture. Attacks on union leaders were often carried out in close coordination with the owners of the workplaces, and court cases filed in recent years provide some of the best documented examples of direct involvement by local subsidiaries of foreign multinationals. In the years prior to the coup in Argentina, the rise of left-wing militancy had affected foreign companies both economically and personally. Between 1972 and 1976, five executives from the auto company Fiat were assassinated. The fortunes of such companies changed dramatically when the junta took power and implemented Chicago school policies. Now they could flood the local market with imports, pay lower wages, lay workers off at will, and send their profits home unhindered by regulations. several multinationals effusively expressed their gratitude. On the first new year under military rule in Argentina, Ford Motor Company took out a celebratory newspaper advertisement, openly aligning itself with the regime. 1976. Once again, Argentina finds its way. 1977. New year of faith and hope for all Argentines of goodwill. Ford Motor of Argentina and its people commit themselves to the struggle to bring about the great destiny of the fatherland. Foreign corporations did more than thank the juntas for their fine work. Some were active participants in the terror campaigns. In Brazil, several multinationals banded together and financed their own privatized torture squads. In mid-1969, just as the junta entered its most brutal phase, an extra-legal police force was launched called Operation Bandeirantes, known as OBAN. Staffed with military officers, OBAN was funded, according to Brazil Never Again, by contributions from various multinational corporations, including Ford and General Motors. It was in Argentina, however, that the involvement of Ford's local subsidiary with the terror apparatus was most overt. The company supplied cars to the military, and the green Ford Falcon sedan was the vehicle used for thousands of kidnappings and disappearances. The Argentine psychologist and playwright Eduardo Pavlovsky described the car as the symbolic expression of terror, a deathmobile. While Ford supplied the junta with cars, the junta provided Ford with a service of its own, ridding the assembly lines of troublesome trade unionists. Before the coup, Ford had been forced to make significant concessions to its workers, 1 hour off for lunch instead of 20 minutes, and 1% of the sale of each car to go to social service programs. All that changed abruptly. The Ford factory in suburban Buenos Aires was turned into an armed camp. In the weeks that followed, it was swarming with military vehicles, including tanks and helicopters buzzing overhead. Workers have testified to the presence of a battalion of 100 soldiers permanently stationed at the factory. It looked like we were at war in Ford, and it was all directed at us, the workers, recalled Pedro Troiani, one of the union delegates. Soldiers prowled the facility, grabbing and hooding the most active union members, helpfully pointed out by the factory foreman. Troiani was among those pulled off the assembly line. He recalled that, before detaining me, they walked me around the factory. They did it right out in the open so that the people would see. Most startling was what happened next. Rather than being rushed off to a nearby prison, Troiani and others say soldiers took them to a detention facility that had been set up inside the factory gates. In their place of work, where they had been negotiating contracts just days before, workers were beaten, kicked, and in two cases, electroshocked. They were then taken to outside prisons where the torture continued for weeks, and in some cases, months. In 2002, federal prosecutors filed a criminal complaint against Ford Argentina on behalf of Troiani and 14 other workers, alleging that the company is legally responsible for the repression that took place on its property. Mercedes-Benz, a subsidiary of Daimler Chrysler, is facing a similar investigation. According to the Latin American historian Karen Robert, by the end of the dictatorship, virtually all the shop floor delegates had been disappeared from the country's biggest firms, such as Mercedes-Benz, Chrysler, and Fiat Concord. It wasn't only unionists who faced preemptive attack. It was anyone who represented a vision of society built on values other than pure profit. Particularly brutal throughout the region were the attacks on farmers who had been involved in the struggle for land reform.